Welcome to the Indie Media Club podcast. I'm Ben Aston, founder of the Indie Media Club. We're on a mission to help independent, bootstrapped media entrepreneurs succeed, to help people who create, promote, and monetize through content do it better. Check out indiemedia.club to find out more. So today I'm joined by Oliver Lindberg, and Oliver grew up in the northwest of Germany, moved to the UK in 2001, and lives in Bath with his wife, daughter, and five chickens. That's two more chickens than I have. He's the former editor of Net Magazine, and he's now working as an independent editor. He's a content consultant and a conference curator. We're going to talk about a bit today. He works with brands including Google, Shopify, and Adobe. And in 2017, he founded a community conference for front-end developers, UX, UI designers with a focus on actionable takeaways, and that's called Pixel Pioneers. So keep listening to today's podcast to learn how to create compelling content that connects with your community. There you go. So, hey, Oliver, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
So I just want to dig into your story a bit first. You're a trained journalist, and then you ended up working at Net Magazine, started off doing your own thing. How is it that you decided to end up doing your own thing rather than working for other people? What was the kind of, how did that come about?
Well, I kind of fell into it. As you said, I worked on Net Magazine for a long time. I edited this magazine, which was kind of the leading print publication for web designers and front-end developers. And I had been doing that for quite a while. You know, there were kind of like brand extensions that we did. We launched Generate, which was a conference for web designers, a conference that we held in London and some other cities, New York. And then we tried something in San Francisco. So I got to the point where I was the editor of the magazine, but I didn't really want to go into management as such. You know, I didn't really want to, right, to publish other publications and stuff like that. So I was enjoying editing, and I was also enjoying doing the conference. So, you know, I just kind of thought that I tried on my own.
Yeah. So I'm curious, just digging into a bit, what you don't like about being a publisher, because obviously you were in that role at a publisher. Most of our listeners are probably more on the publishing end of things. What was it that made you think, hey, I don't want to create a publication, because you've obviously got a lot of experience doing that, but instead you just want to focus on the writing itself?
Yeah, it's not so much the creation of the publication, because I did enjoy that. It's more like, you know, the things that come with being a publisher, like, you know, budgets and targets and stuff. I think I'm a little bit more hands-on. So I love curating and I love writing. I think it's a bit of a mix. I'm very well connected. So I like, you know, finding people that can then write about a specific topic, because, you know, my background is journalism. I'm neither a web designer nor a front-end developer. So I'm more like, I'm the curator, you know, that brings everything together. So I enjoyed doing the magazine, but then I thought, you know, going freelance, I can do this kind of stuff for clients as well. You know, the stuff that I do now is still very similar to what I did beforehand on Net Magazine. It's just not, you know, in one handy package. It's kind of like distributed across, you know, various platforms and for various clients. But like the core of it is still like practical, inspiring content for UX, UI designers and front-end developers.
Which is kind of what your Pixel Pioneers is all about as well. So Pixel Pioneers, yeah, is kind of your publication of all the, it's the, yeah, culmination of that work in a way. So take us back to the beginning of that. When you decided, hey, I'm not going to create a publication, but I'm going to create a conference. What was the kind of rationale for what led you into going into conferences? You talked about Generate before from Net Magazine. Was that really the impetus for starting Pixel Pioneers?
It was, in a way. I really enjoyed doing Generate, and, you know, it was kind of the magazine come to life. You know, you could do all these things that at the moment we can't do, meeting people and being in one room, you know, bringing people together and networking and learning from, you know, from the leading industry figures, you know, and curating really practical content for people that they then, you know, they can take away what they learned and then take it to their job and apply it straight away. And what I liked about doing that, there was a thing that I thought, you know, there's a lot of conferences that are very expensive. And there's a lot of conferences in all the big cities. You know, you have conferences in London, you have conferences in New York, San Francisco, Toronto, you know. But I felt there was a bit of a gap for local conferences. You know, I live in Bath, which is just down the road from Bristol. Bristol is the next bigger city here. And Bristol had a very vibrant community, but it was mostly meetups, you know, a very strong UX scene, quite a bit of product design. But there wasn't really a professional conference for web designers or UX, UI designers and front-end developers. So the idea was kind of to bring conferences to people's doorsteps and make it affordable, so that they didn't have to pay travel to go to a hotel, pay for flights and all that kind of stuff.
And so what's your vision for Pixel Pioneer? Because I think you've done, is it three Pixel Pioneer conferences?
I did three in Bristol, and there were actually a couple in Belfast as well that I did at the beginning. The vision is to kind of restart the conferences. You know, it's been quite a challenging year with COVID-19 and the pandemic. So I'm kind of itching to restart the conference and hopefully put it on next year, and then, you know, just go from there. Because the last time I did the conference in June last year, 2019, yeah, I think it was like the best edition yet. There was a lot of good feedback. There was a buzz about it. It was busy. There were sponsors, you know, in the breaks, people were networking with sponsors and with each other. There was just, you know, was just something about it. And I miss doing that. So I'm kind of, yeah, as I said, really itching to bring that back next year. Fingers crossed.
And so obviously you decided not to take the conference virtual, which many people did in the kind of event space. Tell us why. What was your kind of rationale behind that? And your kind of thinking about virtual events and how they work with in real life events.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of conferences that are doing great stuff at the moment. You know, there's lots of conferences that have gone remote and are innovating in that space. But I run Pixel Pioneers completely on my own. So it's conferences, as you know, are a lot of hard work anyway. But to then pull it off remotely and attract enough attendees and sponsors to make it worthwhile is really hard. And because the whole idea of Pixel Pioneers is, as I said, it's local conferences. It's about bringing people from not just the UK, but from other places into the conference, so that people make people accessible, make the speakers accessible, so people can have like a proper conversation in a room. So it's not just like the talks. The talks are about like 40 minutes, but you have breaks in between where, you know, everyone can have a chat, or afterwards go somewhere and have a drink and actually talk with the speaker and dig a little bit deeper. And I feel that's something that you can't really do remotely as such. It's not quite the same.
Yeah.
You know, you have the talks, but then after the talk, you know, to engage the audience is quite, it's quite a feat. So I thought, because I have this other side of my business, content, written content, I concentrate on that for the time being and work with my clients there. And when it's time to, when the time has come that we can all meet in person again, I bring it back.
Yeah. Well, let's switch gears and talk about compelling content, because this is where I guess it all started with Pixel Pioneers. This is where it starts with you from Net Magazine. Talk to us about creating content what does excellent content look like to you? Because there's so much crap on the internet. what are the hallmarks for you of an excellent piece of content from this, I guess, journalistic lens that you started out with?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. There is a lot of crap on the internet, and I think it's becoming a little bit of a lost art. As you said, my background is purely journalistic, so I've kind of learned the skills of the trade. For me, a good article is a lot more than clickbait. You know, it's not just about pulling the readers in. It is well written content that actually has practical and inspiring information in it, and that is not only well written but also well structured. You know, on the internet, you know, it's slightly different. You have to make it easily digestible, with a few crossheads in subheadings, maybe bullet points and stuff like that, images, videos. And, you know, when I do my research for my own articles and I, read other articles, it's become a bit of a lost art. You know, there are so many typos in articles. People don't bother to proofread and stuff like that. And I think that's kind of the stuff that's important. That's what sets good articles apart from, not so good articles, because, people notice, it kind of reflects on your brand as well. You know, when you read an article and it's kind of littered with mistakes, people notice and they might not come back.
Yeah. And I think there's definitely a focus on, quantity over quality. Although I think there is a bit of a shift or a realization that as Google's becoming more interested in quality, people's kind of following along. But how do you break through the noise of content on the internet? When you're writing a topic, you're writing a piece for someone, what are some of the techniques you use to break through the noise and make your piece of content? You're saying you're not wanting to use clickbaity headlines. So what do you do to break through the noise?
Well, sometimes, it depends on who you work with. I try to avoid the clickbaity headlines if I can, but I'm not always the one who writes the final headline that the client goes with. SEO is still important, so sometimes I get assignments, and it depends on whether the client is more SEO driven. If they are, then they probably give you guidelines what kind of keywords they want you to put in. Otherwise, when I have more freedom, I just try and write a really engaging story and digest it in a way that, you can find the important information easily when you scroll through the page. As I say, there can be crossheads, there can be lists, there can be all kinds of things. I like putting videos into my articles if they're helpful. For example, when you interview someone, and I often interview people who give talks at conferences. So that's another nice resource to add to an article, to put a conference talk in there. So if people are really into the topic, they can dig a little bit deeper and just, watch an actual talk without going to the conference. And there's so much content that's freely available on the internet these days. So many conferences, including mine. We make this information freely available on YouTube.
And so it's sounding like for you, engaging content is content that's architected well. So there is a content architecture, or there's a user experience that you're thinking about on the page in terms of formatting it in a way that's digestible, understandable, but also making it feature rich so that people, it's interesting. There's videos in there, there's embedded tweets, or there's features within it to hold people's interest.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's so much you can do on the internet that you can't do when you're writing for print. And I think that's a great opportunity to include audio or video. And you just really break it down, make the paragraphs a little bit shorter, make it easily digestible. And I think when I write an article and I edit my own content, I go through it and read it and see how would I react if I was the reader? What is the most important information here? What do I want to get out of this article that I'm reading?
And so tell us about the kind of editorial lens that you add to content. So perhaps when you're reviewing other people's content, we were just talking offline before about how you're creating ebooks at the moment and commissioning other people. So when you're reviewing someone else's content, what are the things that you're looking for to evaluate whether or not it's good enough, whether or not it needs editing, whether or not something needs to change? Are there some things that you have on a checklist, or how do you kind of go through that process and evaluate it?
It really depends from writer to writer, because a lot of the people that I work with are not natural writers. You know, they're techie people. They are either designers or developers. And yeah, not everyone is, you know, great at writing. What's important is that the article has a clear structure, that, you know, to kind of tick all the boxes that I mentioned earlier, to make the article easily digestible and to find practical information in the article. So usually the first thing I do when I receive a draft, not just the outline, but the first written draft of an article, and that's usually shared with me via Google Docs, I just go into like the suggesting edits mode. And then just go through the whole article bit by bit and put all my edits in, you know. And that's grammar, that's commas, that's typos, that's things, that's word repetitions, you know, take some word repetitions out, make the whole thing flow a little bit better, add suggestions where I think maybe it could do with a little explanation here, if maybe the author has assumed too much knowledge from the reader. And anything that could kind of like tighten the copy a little bit, maybe take a few words out here and there. So, and then usually it goes through a few rounds of editing. And again, that depends from client to client. When I just work with an author on my own, we usually go to maybe two or three editing rounds. And then often when I then submit the article to the actual client, there's another phase in the process where they go in and do their own edits as well. So it can take quite a while until an article is actually finished.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like quite a lengthy process. I'm curious if you can share with us, like, on average, or maybe a range, how much does it cost or how much do you charge to produce a piece of content?
Pricing is really hard, you know. That was one of the most difficult things I had to do when I first went freelance. Because, you know, when I edited the magazine, I had a salary. And then suddenly you're faced with like your writing articles and your commissioning articles, and they're all different lengths and they're all different topics. So, you know, they need different amounts of research, and there's just different work that goes in there. And sometimes, you know, I'm very well familiar with the topic. Sometimes I'm not. So that was one of the hardest things I had to do. Coming up with first for some jobs with an hourly rate, and then some for some articles to come up with a flat rate for an article. And again, that depends then with who you work with, because, you know, then you're dealing with people's budgets as well. You know, not everyone can afford the same thing. But like as a general rule of thumb, when I write an article that's about, let's say, just around 2,000 words long, I usually charge £400 for that. And then when you do ebooks, that really depends on a case-by-case basis, because ebooks are my work, because you're creating the content. The ebooks that I put together often feature several different authors. So you need to kind of source them. Then you need to kind of coordinate it, everything, make sure everything comes in on time. You have to chase people multiple times. And then, because it's not just a piece of content that goes up on the blog, there is more value for the client as well, because they are getting an ebook that they use as a piece of content marketing, sometimes to collect data, to collect email addresses, sometimes to promote certain products that are new, because it's often like, you know, very subtle content marketing. So it's really hard, this pricing thing. And I've been doing this for almost four years now, and I'm finally, I think, in a bit of a swing of things where this is getting a little bit easier, and people kind of know what my rates are, and it's not such a headache every time, you know, you talk to a new client and you have to price something. And it's really one of the hardest things to do.
Yeah. And so I think, because one of the things that the people who are commissioning you to write these pieces will be thinking about is the ROI, of course, on the whatever it is you're producing. And so is that a conversation you ever get into when you're negotiating or talking about pricing? Or do you just say, hey, kind of take it or leave it?
I usually explain, you know, when you put a proposal together, I usually include a kind of reasoning why it would be that price and why, for example, it's an ebook, it costs more than like a selection of articles, because of the added value that a client gets there, the added work and the added value.
Yeah. And in terms of, I guess you said you've been working, doing this for a few years now. So can you share any mistakes you've made or things that have gone wrong or things that have gone actually particularly well, surprisingly well, when you published something and found out the content had done really well, or when you discovered or something had gone really badly? Any good or bad stories?
I mean, that's always great when you get some feedback, and one of the articles that you've put together is one of the articles that got the most traffic within a given year. You know, that's always great feedback. That's happened a few times for some work that I've done with Shopify, that some of my articles were the ones that were the most popular ones. In terms of horror stories, just I think one of the worst things that has kind of ever happened to me in my career was when I did an interview and talked to someone for about, I think, almost an hour, and then I realized at the end of it that it didn't record. You know, it's one of those things, I think, that everyone goes through once and then never again. The guy that I interviewed at the time, you know, was really good about it. And we did the whole interview again and went through the same questions and stuff like that. But since then, I've always used multiple devices to record, you know, not just rely on one. At the time, it was a dictaphone. Now I record on the phone, but I often, you know, record on screen at the same time, so that doesn't happen again. Because, you know, that's a shocker when you come off the call and you go like, "Oh my god, it's in the record."
What do you do now? Do you confess? Yeah, that's cool. And I think actually this is a hallmark. I think of many of your pieces of content, and is the fact that, and I think this is the journalistic component. Most of the things that you write, I mean, you talked about people contributing to your articles, but I think a hallmark of the stuff that you write is that you're canvassing opinions from lots of different people. You're getting perspectives on the story or the topic from a lot of different people. You're not just making this all up yourself. How important is that to what you're doing, and how consciously are you doing that and deliberately? Because in some ways it does make writing the article easier, because you're just asking other people the questions and they create the content for you. But obviously that's a lot of work. So how do you kind of balance that? Well, I can write about the topic, or I can ask someone else about it. How does that work?
I think that kind of stuff lends a lot of expertise and gravitas to an article. Authority. It's authority to an article. Because as I said, my background isn't really design or development, even though I've been in the industry now for like 15 years or something like that. You know, I know design and stuff like that, but I'm also very well connected. And, you know, some of the work that I get, they're assignments. So I just, you know, I get given a brief and then I fill the brief. But I also am often given the freedom to interview people. And then I usually choose these people myself and pitch ideas to the client of who I think would be really interesting to interview. And then there are some articles where it's like, as you said, a huge selection of experts contributing and contributing quotes. And in a way, that does make it easier, but it also makes it more difficult because then you're faced with the whole coordination of everything. And, you know, as you're dealing with people, there's a lot of chasing involved. People disappear, people have lives, people, there's all kinds of stuff happening. So sometimes people just disappear completely from the surface of the earth. And you don't know what's happening. So then you suddenly need to step in and find someone else. So, yeah.
So, and do you use, I mean, Harrow is obviously a service that many people use to source expert quotes for their articles or insights. Do you ever use that, or are you just relying on your network?
I'm mostly relying on my network because I've been doing this for so long now. I know a lot of people that when someone says like user experience design or something else specific, I know the first few people I can talk to. And then I do Google, I Google people as well. And I look at a lot of conference sites, actually, you know, what's going on the conference circuit. What are the interesting topics there and what are people talking about and who's talking about these things? I mean, I always find a lot of really interesting people through conference sites.
Yeah. I mean, and let's go back to talking about Pixel Pioneers. So when you decided to launch that, how did you build your audience to around, I mean, you didn't have a publication and somehow you were able to gather people together, create an audience. Can you just explain how you did that?
Yeah. I mean, people knew me from the magazine.
Right.
You know, I'd been doing the magazine for quite a while and while I was on there, I kind of grew my audience. I was at least a fairly regular user of Twitter, and I'm on LinkedIn. So I built up a kind of social following. And when I then founded the conference, I could tap into that. People around Bristol knew me as well because I'm local. So when I then launched a conference there, I promoted it on my Twitter. I promoted it on LinkedIn. And then I slowly but surely built up a mailing list. I started with a newsletter that kind of promoted the kind of articles that I had worked on that I'd either written or had kind of been involved in. So the newsletter featured practical content, and so it wasn't just a conference. So people kind of signed up to that. I grew the mailing list. I grew the network. So it actually went surprisingly well with the first conference. You know, it was busy. It's not a huge conference. It's a community conference. You know, so
yeah.
For the first conference, I had about 100 people there, which I think for a small local community event is a really good size. And it's grown to like about 150. And it's people who know me. I get a few regulars. There's always a few people who, it's a local conference. So most of the people come from either Bristol or from the southwest of the UK.
Yeah.
But there's always a few that come, across the conference through, conference directories. You know, there's a lot of them online, whether it's Smashing Magazine or CSS Tricks. Or finduxevents.com and stuff like that. So I make sure that my conference is listed on all these directories. And then sometimes people from the US, from elsewhere in Europe, find out about the conference, see the lineup and what's being covered, and that there's a focus on very practical takeaways with like an international lineup of speakers. And it's affordable. People buy a ticket and they turn up.
Nice. And so what, apart from COVID, which is clearly the biggest challenge to putting on a in real life conference right now, what are some of the biggest challenges you faced in curating and creating a conference?
The biggest challenges. I think a conference always succeeds or falls down with its actual program. So, you know, I always make sure that I have a really nice mix. A diverse mix of voices and a diverse mix of topics. So I focus on practical takeaways. So I make sure that the talks that are featured at the conferences are quite practical. And people have like digestible information that they can apply to their own projects. And then maybe there's one talk in there as well that's a little bit more inspiring, someone showing off more, a little bit more design work. But I think it's this practical content that really resonates with people. Because a lot of these big conferences now have talks where there's a lot of, let's say, high-level content, you know, where people talk about theories a lot and a lot of stuff that is only applicable to certain size projects and certain size companies. You know, what's applicable to Google is not necessarily applicable to a small agency, you know, that is maybe struggling to get by with the resources that they have. So I think that's always a very important bit as well.
How do you curate that though? Because I share the same kind of idea around the importance of practical takeaways. And I've been to conferences where they ask you to hold the person's hand next to you and say things and that kind of thing. And like, I'm not here at a conference because I wanted to hold some random person's hand and say, chant something. I'm here because I want to learn things. But I think that actually getting people who are able to teach practical and give practical takeaways is a lot harder to find those people because they're practitioners rather than conference speakers who typically they have their talks, right? They have their five talks, and you can have your talk on emotional health in the workplace, or you can have the talk on leading your team or whatever it might be, which are these very kind of high level inspirational talks. So as you've been curating the content, how have you kind of battled against that to ensure that it was actually practical and the takeaways were actually real, not handholdy?
I think the way that I select my speakers, I do a lot of research either online or in person. So online, I look at a lot of conference videos, check speakers out before and check what kind of topics they talk about, what are they like as a speaker, what are the presentations like, how are they structured. But then I also try and go to events and attend events regularly. And in my kind of industry, so design and development, that's usually people with a similar mindset that are focusing on the practical takeaways. So I try and go to conferences like Smashing Conference or Beyond Tolerant. I'm a big fan of the Beyond Tolerant conference series in Germany. And then also meetups. You know, I run my conference in Bristol, which, as I said, has a very vibrant community, and there are a lot of meetups going on. So I try and go there, and at meetups you often can check out new speakers that are working. It's almost like the comedy stand-up circuit, you know, because people on meetups try out new material, you know, that they then take to the bigger stage. And sometimes you find speakers that haven't made it to the big conferences, but have something really interesting to say and actually have a really interesting talk that they want to share with people. And that way I found some really good people because, you know, the conference is, as I said, more for the local community. But I think it's important to not only just fly people into this conference from all kinds of different places, but also kind of celebrate the local community. So I always try and make sure that there's at least a couple of local speakers at the conference as well that might be well known or might not be so well known. And then they bring like new voices and new perspectives to the conference, because that's really important. You know, as I said, there's speakers that have like one talk a year and they go to all the conferences. It's important to have a mix, to have a really nice balance of like topics and new speakers and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So what else is on your roadmap? What are you personally working on trying to get better at? What does 2021 hold for you?
I hope 2021 will be a lot better than 2020, to be honest. So I'd like to restart the conference, if that's possible. At the moment, that's lined up for June. You know, fingers crossed that things will be more settled by June. Other than that, obviously, COVID has affected all my clients as well. Mm. So the work that I had this year has slightly differed to what originally anticipated. You know, clients have slightly shifted direction. They have shifted budgets around. So this year I've taken on, also because I couldn't do the conference, I've taken on a lot more work that is a little bit more, you know, assignments rather than me pitching ideas and writing about the topics that I might particularly feel passionate about. So for 2021, I would like to conduct a few more interviews than this year, because that's something I really enjoy. You know, find, similar to what I just said about the conferences, find new voices and interview them, and then kind of share that with the community. And there's so many like interesting voices. You know, I think this year especially has kind of brought that to the forefront, where people are a little bit more aware how important it is to have diverse voices in any industry, you know.
Yeah.
But especially in tech, you know, that you don't have a conference or publication where, you know, everyone looks the same.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's finish up with a lightning round. I'm curious, what is the best advice you think you've ever received?
I think the best advice, it's not over-promising. You know, as a freelancer, it's very easy to, especially at the beginning of your career, it's very easy to say yes to everything. But I think it's really good advice to be more cautious with that, because, you know, if you over-promise, you're only going to disappoint and frustrate or annoy clients, which is really difficult. So I'd rather say maybe, and then we have a little discussion about it, whether I can really fit it in. I think, yeah, the best advice I've ever received is don't over-promise and, you know, maybe over-deliver. You know, I think that's a good mix.
And which of your personal habits do you think has contributed most to your success?
Well, being German, I'm quite organized. So it's like this, I think, German efficiency. I think organizational skills, I think, are really important when you're freelance and when you're running your own business. And that means, as I just said, not to take on too much work, but also being organized with, you know, how much can you actually get done in a day? So yeah. I work with to-do lists. I still write my to-do lists on paper, you know, and just so I have a list on my desk and what can I actually get done today or this week? And then, you know, organization around, money obviously is important as well. That's pricing and making sure, you know, you have enough work lined up so, you know, you can pay your bills, but also to take a break, because that's really important as well, that you don't burn out and take on too much stuff. You know, it's a good idea to have a break and earn enough money so that you can do that, and then, you know, just tell your clients that you're taking a few weeks off.
Yeah.
So you don't burn out, because, you know, that's a danger, especially for a freelancer, I think.
Yeah. Can you share an internet tool or resource that you use regularly?
I use like all the usual suspects, you know, like Slack and Google. I'm not using Twitter as much as I used to anymore, because I don't get that much value out of it anymore. Obviously, I still promote the articles that I write on there and I share them. But I find there's a lot of arguing going on Twitter these days. LinkedIn seems to have become much more useful. I find there's more engagement now when I put something on LinkedIn. So I find stories on LinkedIn. I share my own content on LinkedIn. Otherwise, other tools and resources, specifically for the design and development industry, you know, I check out the blogs of all the clients that I work with, you know, to see what the big trends are. So I look at XD Ideas by Adobe. I look at the Shopify partner blog. I look at Shaping Design by Wix. But I also look at Smashing Magazine. And as I said, I look at a lot of different conference sites to see what are the trends in the industry at the moment, what are the people talking about. And I try and look at it as broadly as possible. When I say design and development, I'm also interested in you know, user experience and project management. And like a big trend this year has been UX writing. And I suddenly noticed there have been a lot of UX writing conferences that have popped up all over the place. And I managed to get some really interesting content and contacts through that. And that's been really interesting to see.
Nice. What book would you recommend and why?
So one of the most interesting books that I've recently read as part of an interview that I did is Design for Cognitive Bias by David Dylan Thomas. And as the title suggests, it's a book that's kind of aimed at designers. But I think whether you're a designer or like a product manager or like a content person, everyone can get something out of that book, because cognitive bias is something that that everyone deals with on a daily basis, and that's our own biases, but it's also the biases of the people that we deal with. And to actually become aware of these biases and then learn strategy to raise awareness with team members or stakeholders, or learn strategies to combat these biases is actually really, really powerful, I think.
And finally, for someone at the beginning of their digital media journey, what is one piece of advice that you would give?
I think at the beginning of your media journey, I think it's important to just produce a lot of your own content and just put it out there. You know, whether you have your own blog or whether you're writing content for different clients, I think it's important to just produce content, share that content, and then kind of slowly build up a following. And while doing that, really focus on the quality of that content that you're putting out. And that's all the stuff that I said earlier, you know, focus on the right grammar. And if you're not sure yourself, run it by someone else before you publish it. You know, don't just rely on the spell check in whatever word processing tool you use, but just show it to someone as well to get their opinion on the article, on the structure, on the writing and the style, but also the actual content, you know. And I think that can be really useful, because don't just do it all on your own. You know, the tech industry is a really close-knit community. And I just mentioned the arguing on Twitter, but there's also a lot of help. You know, I found people are so helpful, especially when there's, you know, a person who wants to break into the industry. I found that people are very eager to offer help, which is really nice to see.
Cool. Oliver, where can people find out more about you and what you're up to?
So my conference site is pixelpioneers.co. And then I'm on Twitter. I'm basically everywhere as Oliver Lindberg. I'm at Oliver Lindberg on Twitter. On LinkedIn, I think I'm Oliver-Lindberg. I'm on Instagram. This is the other way around there. I'm Lindberg.Oliver there. So I think if you just Google me, there's not many Oliver Lindbergs. I think there's one in Sweden as a DJ, but otherwise you will find my content. I'm very
busy. That's not you when you're on holiday.
No, I think this DJ did a remix of Another Day in Paradise by Phil Collins. It's definitely not me.
Cool, Oliver, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been great having you with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
And if you like what you heard today, please subscribe and stay in touch on indiemedia.club. And please leave us a review on iTunes too if you like it. But until next time, thank you so much for listening.